subject, and this seminar will be on the creativity of or creative film criticism. So our first speaker is Dr. Robert Chan, who is a tutor in Oriental Studies and Chinese in St. Anne's College. And today he's going to talk about conjuring and the Confucian ritual canon.
Alright, thank you. I have been asked to talk about commentary. I see that there are China specialists, there are two, and some Japan specialists here. So some of this will probably come across as being rather, if not basic, then almost ludicrously sort of just common knowledge, but that's the risk we take. This is an example of a Chinese text printed in woodblock. I mean, this was in the Qing Dynasty, probably early 19th century, but books looked like this for a very long time, 1,000 years or more. You'll see there's rather large print sort of towards this side. So this is one of the ritual canons. This is the main text of the actual canonical text itself. This is commentary, and you'll see sort of a large character in a kind of partly bracketed up above, which is the sub-commentary, which was written in the main commentary was written in the 2nd century AD, and the sub-commentary probably in the early 7th century. And the names of the two commentators appear here. Master Zheng, I'll talk about him later, and the Kongyin Da, I won't really say anything about him. And you can see that, well, you can't see because the page doesn't go on, but the sub-commentary is much longer than the main commentary. So commentary is an extensive form of writing in pre-modern China. And I suppose that it can be seen as a kind of criticism, though I'll leave that to people who do criticism to decide. It isn't literary in the sense, I mean, the form I'm going to talk about today is probably more akin to biblical exegesis than anything else. It's not literary. The texts are not really literature as such. And I'm more, in myself, more of the equivalent of a classical historian or an ancient historian and a philologist, except that I work with China and classical Chinese instead of Latin and Greek. I don't deal with literature, but it is worth mentioning that pre-modern literature in China is a very large field of study. There's an awful lot of it around. So what I'll do today first is to give some general background, explaining what the texts are like, try to give some examples of the commentaries and what they do, and then sort of finish up with some more general observations on how they function creatively, and added to or did things that the original text didn't. So to start with, we have the four traditional bibliographic categories. These appeared probably sometime around the middle of the first millennium. And what they are is Chinese archivists, especially imperial archivists, classified texts first into these very broad divisions and then many, many subdivisions beneath those, which in effect also represent academic subjects, so the division of knowledge in pre-modern China. So what we have here, the canonical texts are written with a word that means the sort of warp of a woven cloth. So it's sort of the texts that hold everything together, the canonical texts. People often translate them as classics, and in a Buddhist or Taoist religious context, they're called scriptures. I think calling them classics is misleading because you're likely to think of something like Homer or Moby Dick, and it's not that kind of a classic at all. They're really canonical texts, really more like scriptures because they lay down the rules and they are authoritative texts and their correctness, the truth of them is taken as a given. And then the other three categories, the histories, the masters like philosophy and other kinds of specialized knowledge, the arts of war, all that sort of thing. And then finally, the collectanea, individual writings, which include belles lettres, poetry, essays, inscriptions, memorials, all sorts of things. Commentaries are written to earlier texts in the first three categories, but very rarely to the sort of literary So the first category is the Confucian canon. So it is a branch of learning in Chinese, which we can call canon studies, the studies of the canons. And you can make very, very approximately say this is comparable to theology in the West. So the truth of the text, as I said, was a given, but interpreting them is a rather complex discipline. So this is what commentaries do. And commentaries in the first instance, and also other canonical interpretations, help readers understand what the texts say, because that isn't always straightforward. They're often rather old language, difficult to follow. But very importantly, they also put the commentator's own ideas across. But commentators can't express their own ideas because no one will listen to them or believe them. The canonical texts have the authority. Therefore, commentators usually somehow work out ways of putting their own ideas into their commentaries and say, well, that's what the text is saying. So I didn't say it, the canonical text said it. So the meaning of the canons and which parts of the canons should be followed, because often you get different passages that say different things, they're contradictory. So you need to come to a decision based on some academic analysis which is correct. So that is also contested. And as I said too, the canonical scholarship can vector new ideas off these canonical passages. So a great deal in traditional Chinese political discourse, also a lot of educated discourse in general, is rich in allusions to these texts and rather difficult to read unless you know them very well. And all sort of educated so-called scholars or officials will have memorized the canonical texts, which is a huge job. There are a lot of them. And they're all sort of part of the kind of living corpus of bits of text that they string together and fill their ordinary language with. There are now 13 of them. Back in the period, the early imperial period, there were 5. And in content, they're quite varied. They range from something you could call almost proto-literature, the Book of Songs, which was originally sung. So also music as well as language. But the word for that has become the word for poetry in later times. We also have history, the so-called spring and autumn annals with commentaries, and also divination and cosmology with the I Ching, or the so-called I Ching, that most people have probably heard of. But the category that I want to consider is the second one on the list there, is the category of what we usually translate as ritual, this word li in Chinese. And the discipline of it is called, well, ritual studies li xue. It isn't exactly like modern ritual studies, which is very theoretical, but it's canonical. And in some ways, certainly politically, arguably this is the most important category of all the canonical texts. So it isn't just ritual as we understand it, but it includes also etiquette, norms of civilized behavior, institutions and structures of government. And it was the moral and cultural basis of civilization. And it was thought to be universalizing. So it could spread to any culture. It didn't have to be Chinese. It was also a system of order superior to law. We shouldn't idealize it because it defined a hierarchical order in which everyone's status and role was defined. And in modern terms, we would find a lot of that difficult to take. Gender inequality and so on. So all of this, I study Li as part of an effort to understand what Confucianism is, not from a philosophical standpoint with abstract ideas and values, but more a sort of living culture. What did the people who call themselves Confucians do? So committed Confucians are believers, and certainly modern Chinese scholars who study Confucianism will identify other scholars that they refer to as a Xintu, or a believer. And that's sort of something you need to know about this guy, because everything he says will be colored by his belief. And there is a revival of Confucianism underway in China now as a sort of alternative way of governance and ideas for sort of systems of order, legitimacy, that are alternative, say, to democracy or Western ways of doing things. But a key difference from religions is that Confucianism isn't organized around belief in a deity. It has religious elements, but that doesn't define what it is or the truth of it. Also, you can't become a Confucian just by being baptized or declaring yourself a Muslim, for example. It's really an education. Someone who is highly educated, thoroughly steeped in the canonical texts, a member of the elite in traditional Chinese society, and someone who has the qualifications to participate in government, become an official, and the duty to advise and participate in governance, even if they don't hold office. This is especially over the last 1,000 years. Before that, the examination system that people qualified for office with was not very well developed. So just a few words about the formation of the canons. So we don't call them scriptures, or most people don't, a few do, but they were believed to have a more than ordinary human origin. So they were thought to come from, say, the sage kings, the ideal sovereigns of the past, say, roughly 1000 BC especially, or from Confucius himself, who was also thought to have written some of these texts and was believed to be this word, a sage, which is third from the end there on the screen. There is no really consistent definition of the word. For some, it simply meant absolute mastery of something. For example, the game of what we think of as the Japanese word for go. You can be a shun in that, means you have perfect mastery of it. For some, it's a superhuman sort of state that anyone can achieve by effort. But for others, it was something inborn, including knowledge of the future, and many people believed that Confucius had been born knowing everything already. So it's rather difficult to get a grasp on it, but the texts do come from a more than ordinary set of human beings. So this is sort of the traditional view. Scholarship over the last century or so has changed this somewhat, both in China and outside. Only a few parts of the earliest layers of some of the texts actually come from the Western Zhou, very early Western Zhou period, or through the Western Zhou. There are snippets that seem to, some of the songs and other bits of text. Also, archaeological discoveries of texts from the 3rd and 4th centuries BC show that earlier versions of canonical texts were quite nebulous. So later times believed they'd been created in early times, they were already there, fully born, but in fact they weren't. They were not fixed, they had many variations, and a really quite indefinite divide between what was written and the oral teachings that kind of surrounded it, sort of a nimbus of quite rather difficult to define. This is actually an early text. Either very early Han Dynasty or probably 2nd or 3rd century BC, and it's written on slips of either wood or bamboo. You can see how the characters were done. They were put together and tied together to make scrolls. So they had no paper yet at that point. So really, it wasn't until roughly the year zero or thereabouts that the canonical texts as we have them now were beginning to be assembled and settled. And it was over the next century or two that they sort of became literally set in stone, or carved in stone, the stone classics, as they call them. So to say something now about the ritual canons. So tradition says that there was originally a canon of ritual that existed since very early times. But we're pretty clear, these four, we're really four plus two more, are some of the branches of knowledge or the texts or bodies of knowledge that Confucius taught. And the first two, the first one was a text that was quite firmly set, it was very oral, it's the songs, didn't change much. The second one was still changing quite a bit, but they were at least texts. But in the time of Confucius, the ritual and the music were not yet texts. They were bodies of knowledge. But by the next famous Confucian scholar, Mencius, he quotes from the ritual. He says, the ritual says, and then has snippets of text, some of which still exist in bits of the modern ritual canon. So we think that somehow between Confucius and Mencius, a ritual canon of some sort was created. So, the ritual texts as we have them now, there are three. three ritual canons. And it's thought that the original ritual canon is the first one, the Ili, sort of deportment in ritual, is at least a partial survival of the original canon of ritual. And it has quite detailed instructions for things like funerals and capping ceremonies and archery and drinking ceremonies and all sorts of things. So probably sometime in the late 5th or early 4th centuries it must have been compiled. And importantly, it contains a very early layer of commentary, which is sort of in the middle there between the two blocks, the G commentary and the E. And it was sort of additional supplementary information and explanations about the main text. And the same word, record, also appears as the title of the second that I've got listed here, which is the G, the records of ritual, which seems to be because it's quite a heterogeneous collection of texts, supplementary materials on ritual forms, cleansing and all sorts of things, plus more general essays on the principles of Confucian teachings. So the text as we have it now seems to have been compiled in the 1st century BC, but the texts in it mostly come from the pre-imperial period, and at least one of them has been excavated from the tomb from the late 4th century BC. And it also contains bits of text which match quotes from the rituals by Menges. And then we have the Zhouli. This is the sort of rituals or institutions of Zhou, Zhou being the early kingdom from sort of 1000 BC down, but didn't actually get exterminated until 256 BC, but was completely ineffectual by that point. And it's a very different sort of text. It's quite systematic. It's not a compendium of different things. And it isn't centrally related to ritual at all. It's a systematic blueprint for the structure of a government, supposedly the Western Zhou government. So it's a list of officials and their duties. And many of these do include rituals, but it's actually a blueprint for a government. It's very idealized, but some have gone so far as to describe this text as a sort of constitution for the structure of governments in East Asia, which is a useful comparison to make to shock people, but it's obviously taking things much too far. It isn't a constitution, line by line, word by word, anything like it. They're only rather general shapes of which number of ministers, which category, numbers of departments that do match it. So a systematic text, seems to be from pre-imperial times. It purports to actually have been written back around 1000 BC, which is obviously just not true. But it has been proved that it incorporates some sort of lore or records, which does go back to very early times. There's a professor at Princeton, Martin Caron, who's shown that the use of a particular word, a kind of official, is something we otherwise only know from bronze inscriptions that were dug up in, say, the 8th, 9th centuries BC. It isn't known in any other text, so there is something going on there. But all of that about the canons themselves, how about the commentaries? First to mention the 2nd century AD commentary, Zheng Xuan. And this man represents the culmination of Han Dynasty scholarship. So in later editions of many canons, his is the first layer of commentary. So this is he lived late in the Eastern Han Dynasty, there's his name. And his was this kind of commentary, a dual commentary, which is has become the primary commentary in the small writing. So there were a lot of previous commentators at work before him, and there were two major factions of scholarship that were as much sort of political factions as they were purely academic, the so-called Old Text and New Text schools. And he combined the two. He also had synthesized them into one system. And he also quoted from many earlier scholars, and by name, he would say, so-and-so says this, so he actually said that they were. So a lot of earlier scholarship is preserved in his commentaries. But what did he actually do? Oh yes, and one more important point, he played a key role in defining the ritual canon, and in particular, he elevated the Zhouli, named that as being one of he said this is a very important text. If anything, it was the most important for him. And so took the three ritual texts together and wrote the commentators on them and used them to reflect on each other and figure out various problems that were difficult to explain. So if we look at this, I mean, obviously we won't, it's not that clear for one thing, but this whole section here is about ancestral shrines and various sort of kind of altars and other things that were around them. And right at the beginning, he starts explaining various phrases. So he explains this phrase to found a state, and he says what that means is that people are, the king is in fiefing, it doesn't say the king, but feudal lords are in fiefed. So this expression, he says, means feudal lords, and this, these four mean feudal lords, then further enfeoffed sub-feoff lords underneath them. And he explains that the two expressions are different. And that's what they mean. That's all the way down here. And then some of them, even people who are sort of the gentry class who distinguish themselves. And then this is next to, I mean, you won't, if you're not reading the characters, it doesn't matter. You probably can't even if you can read Chinese. But here he says that the ancestral shrine as a sound or as a word is another word. So it's read miao in modern Chinese. There's another word meaning mao, which means appearance. So this is something that commentators of this period frequently did. They would identify words with a similar sound and then say that that tells you a bit about what it means. And he says that the shrine, the ancestral shrine, is kind of an expression, a physical, visible manifestation of the ancestors that are venerated, which in a way is true. The rulers' ancestral shrines were the essential symbol of their rulership. So as far as we know, these words aren't common, but that's what he and a lot of other commentators did. This is another passage, this is in the bottom half, which is about the household gods. These are things like the gates, the central hall, the kitchen stove, and things like that. And here Zhang Xuan does something quite interesting. He refers to, here, he says these are not major deities that people sort of pray to for important matters. They are minor spirits or deities that dwell amongst humankind and watch, they monitor human beings' behavior, people in the family, what are you doing? And then they report your faults to heaven. And as far as we know, that didn't exist at the time this text was created, the Qifan text. But it was quite a conspicuous part of belief in the late second century. So according to this particular formulation, and this is important, that the king, who is the equivalent of the emperor in later times, had seven household gods, feudal lords had five, and the great officers, the sub-feudal lords, had three, and gentry, lineal gentry, had one, and common people just had them in their households. They didn't have actual, they only worshipped the stove in their own household, or the doorway gods. So that's a, and he uses the same, this text uses the same numerical system for the ancestral shrines. The king has seven ancestors, feudal lords five, and great officials three, and so on. But this is one text in the Li Ji. We move to another text, the Qu Li, and here we're told, I lost track of it, but we're told that there are only five. So we're told that the kings made sacrifices to the five household deities. So this is a common problem in the ritual texts. And how did Zhang Xuan deal with it? Very cleverly, he said that, so he needs to choose which one is correct. And he chose the seven. And he says that the five was most likely the system of the Shang dynasty beforehand. So it was okay in its own day, but the Zhou was seven, and the Zhou is more sophisticated with ritual. They had a more elaborate system, and it's better to follow them. So what's the next? To say a little bit about what Zheng Xuan did with his commentaries, he provided a resource also for those who later had to compile precise instructions for the performance of ritual. And the reason he had to do that is that the canonical texts themselves were compiled in a time where the sort of grammar, syntax, and the ritual vessels and practices of ritual were still alive. And so they were not formulated in great detail. They didn't need to be. But by the time Zheng Xuan was alive, a lot of that had either changed or been completely forgotten. So he was really engaged in a process of reconstruction in many cases. And his method was to extrapolate from other similar cases wherever he could find them. So in the case of the household cults, which I've not put up here because I can't read them anywhere properly, due to fuzziness or else not knowing Chinese, which is forgivable. So he has this text, the Li Ji, which describes which seasons the king sacrificed. It does say which kind of sacrificial meat is to be offered, but that's it. So he has to figure out, Zheng Xuan knows, where this happened. So he turns to the other ritual text, the Yi Li, the one with all the funerals and everything, which has a great deal of ritual that takes place in the ancestral shrine, or sort of temple. It's not a public temple, it's a private temple, with a particular layout. It's got gates, outer little sort of gatehouses. It's got a little sort of stage with two pillars in them, and so on. And so what he did was he started, because ancestral ritual sacrifices in the Yili, in this ancestral shrine, had things that were cooked. And there were special kinds of stoves with a particular word, and it tells us exactly where they were put. There were two kinds put in two locations. So he chose one of those locations and said, that is where the stove god is sacrificed to. A lot of others he would put, for example, on the inner doors, the gates, the main hall, and others he really followed as much as he could what it said in the Yili to determine in his commentary to this text, the Li Ji, where to do it. So his overall formulation cannot be found in the ritual canons, and we can be quite skeptical about whether it represents ancient practice, yet he assembled it from the best canonical evidence he had, and many subsequent dynasties after the Han used his descriptions to base even more elaborate ritual instructions of their own, which they never could have done from the original texts. And so for quite a long time, people relied very heavily on him. So he was really performing an essential role mediating between the canons and actual practice centuries later. And in a way, therefore, he was really determining what they really were, you know, what was correct about them. But, just very briefly, a sort of quick ending. Along, eventually, about 1,000 years after Zheng Xuan, we have another chap named Zhu Xi, who sort of is the great synthesizer who pulled together various strands and made it in what we call Neo-Confucianism in English. And he, on the one hand, was a very original thinker. He had a sort of almost semi-scientific investigation of the principles of things and developed his own quite unique philosophy. But he wrote commentaries to many of the old canonical texts in which all these ideas are expressed. He did have some writings, but he managed to work them in, he redefined the canon, he took two chapters out of the Li Ji, raised them up as separate texts, two of the four books, and made some changes to them that he thought were done on philological grounds, but they became two new canons. So we think of him as being a philosopher, a sort of almost pseudo-scientist and other things, and not really, I mean, not an actual scientist, but cosmological, maybe thinking, something quite new, his own form of meditation, for example, that seems to have been influenced by Buddhism. We think of all of that, and yet one of his largest works is the thing listed on the bottom, is an enormous commentary to the ritual canon, and this thing is huge. He applied for funding, just as we applied to the AHRC, to the Imperial Court. He didn't get it, and he did it therefore as a private project with rather large numbers of students and other collaborators. And it wasn't finished by the time he died, but it was continued. And he took the Ely text as the fundamental ritual canon, and all the others were sort of ancillary, Zheng Xuan and others' commentaries, and he built up this huge compendium of ritual. And people point out that the word Li, meaning ritual, as opposed to the word Li, meaning principle or reason, the patterns of things, that he's much more famous for. In fact, he used the word Li for ritual 2 to 3 times more frequently in all of his writings than he did the principle one. So I'll have to leave it there, at risk of 30 minutes is about as far as we can go. That's what he's supposed to look like.
Thank you.
Sometimes they can be bits of previous commentaries, as Robert's saying about some of the Chinese works on the major text, that a whole history of commentary builds up, and commentary becomes tradition very early on. Each commentary incorporates parts of its predecessors. And when I did my commentary on the text for a DPhil many years ago, and that's what I did, and that still goes on in classical commentary. It's a kind of, I'm still in dialogue with these guys in the margin in some way. The text I've given you, just because it's a nice picture, is a different one from the first one I want to talk about. It's Martialis Capella, which is a fun text. I don't want to talk about that. I'd like to talk a little bit about Petronius' Satyrica, as it should be known. We all call it Satyrica because we've seen Fellini's movie, or whatever, very movie. But technically it should be Satyrica, means satyr-like things. A neuter ending. And own is just a genitive plural, so it's a kind of deviation. And in the tradition of the Satyrica, this is, roughly speaking, a novel. It's probably written in the 60s AD under the Emperor Nero. Petronius probably was the guy who sorted out Nero's etiquette of court, so-called arbiter of elegance, who's mentioned by the historian Tacitus. And the Satyrica is a very earthy, realistic, low-life novel set in the Bay of Naples, rather appropriately. It's like, I don't know, The Sopranos goes back to Italy, something like that. If you don't know who The Sopranos are, I apologize. A low-life mafia narrative. The basic plot of the Satyrica, those of you who don't know it, is there is a gay ménage à trois who are bumming around the Bay of Naples doing nothing in particular and getting into various bits of trouble. One of the men of fatwa, Inkulpius, who's highly educated, a sort of a 60s dropout, if you like, is the narrator, and we see things from his perspective. And one of the things that happens fairly early on is they come into contact with someone called Cortella, who's a kind of deviant S&M priestess who does unspeakable things to them. So I could talk forever about the colourful content of the Satirica, but I'm going to be very disciplined and talk about commentary and how it consists of, first of all, reactions to texts. Now, scholars, modern scholars, are agreed that the modern editors of Petronius, especially thinking here of Conrad Müller, who is the most important, are very clear that what we've got here is an interpolated textual tradition. As I say, we've got bits added, and those on the whole are bits in square brackets in the Latin text that I put before you. And at the top of each extract, I've given the name of the scholar who consigned those interpolations to the rubbish bin of history. So Jacobs, fairly early on the first passage, Frankl, as great Oxford scholar, in 1961, the second one, and Müller 1, as we call it, the first edition by Conrad Müller. There are four or five, depending on what you count. So you can see that these are historic interpolations that were in the text for a long time, and in many cases, very recently been removed. And that's part of what the process of classical editing has been going through over hundreds of years. Basically, we get better at it, or we think we get better at it, and we can improve texts. I think most modern scholars are agreed that what we have is an interpolated tradition where bits are stuck in. Now, why are bits stuck in? Is this just readers drawing in the margin during a boring lecture or whatever? No, I think there is a commentary element. So, for example, in the first passage, we have a messenger comes from Cortella, the S&M priestess, to the narrator and his friends, saying that she's not very pleased with them, and they're in some sort of low-life motel. One of the joys of Satirica is all the locations are low-life as well. So again, like the strip bar and the Sopranos. So I'll just read the translation, first passage. While we were speaking, the bar slipped to the its own accord, and the bar across the door. The door suddenly swung open and let in our visitor. It was a veiled woman who had stood with the countryman a little while before, split in brackets. Did you think you had deceived me? She said. I am Portilla's maid. You intruded upon her devotions before her secret chapel. And it turns out Portilla has her own kind of kinky religion, which involves all sorts of unspeakable sexual things being done. But what I want to focus on here is the bit cut out by Jacobs and by modern editors, which is the Latin for the woman who had stood with the countryman a little while before, because that's commentary. And it's an interpretation which is in fact wrong. So whoever put this in the text, I mean, perhaps going back to our picture, it was originally an interlinear gloss or a marginal gloss which then got into the text. So it probably originated as commentary, it probably didn't originate as an attempt to rewrite the text in itself. But as you can see, it's very common in classical text, stuff that's in the margin or between the lines can get copied into the text very easily, as if it were the text. You can see from that picture how these scripts might get mixed up. What we've got here is a reader's reaction trying to tell future readers who the woman was. In fact, this is wrong. This is not the woman who had stood with the countryman a little while before. That's a different character in an entirely different part of the plot. But this is a kind of commentary remark for future readers. And I think you can see that the justification for it is commentary, as we say. It's the kind of thing you might put in the footnotes of a world's classic or whatever. The second example from Satirica 25 is similar. So here we have, we're now in Quartilla's kind of deviant pad. All these nasty things going on, a particularly nasty piece of paedophilia. Here, you have to have a strong stomach to read Petronius, like much of classical literature. And Portilla is addressing her friends. Yes, yes, said Quartilla, you have advised me well. Why shouldn't our Panurgis means all night long? I said, Barry White, all night long, and sexual pun, I suppose. Why shouldn't our Panurgis lose her virginity, since it's a splendid opportunity for it? And immediately a girl was brought out, rather pretty, who seemed to be no more than 7 years old, and then, brackets, and the very one which had first come with Portilla into our room. So again, I think this is a very similar kind of commentary explanation. A reader is telling you which girl he thinks this is. In fact, there was a girl with Portilla earlier, but it's by no means clear that it was this one. So again, perhaps it's a misleading comment, but it's an attempt to elucidate the text, which I think we could call commentary. Next passage, 72.7. This is after the famous episode of the dinner at Trimalchio, the game of Trimalchinus, which some of you may know is this kind of gross meal to which the lowlife protagonists get invited, and it's so gross they just have to run away and leave. It's a famous scene in the Fellini movie. So here they're trying to escape. Since this seems satisfactory, as Gitone, who's one of the three, he's the good-looking one, led us through the portico, we came to the door, where a chained god greeted us with such noise. Sorry, chained up door, but it is not god. That a sculptor's even fell into the pool, and I, likewise drunk, who had been afraid even of a painted dog, was dragged into the same whirlpool. Yep. So, this is, again, I think, a reader making commentary, explaining, saying something about Encolpius, which is a cross-reference to an earlier passage, maybe 29.1, because this seems to refer back to the previous occasion when Encolpius was afraid of a dog. So you can see that all these three are really motivated by the same commentary urge, which is to relate these passages of text to other recent passages of text in the same story. Now, I'll finish Petronius with another example which is slightly different. And here, the Ménage Artois are on a ship on the Bay of Naples, and there's a shipwreck is in prospect, and they're trying to escape from the ship. It's a very melodramatic story. Now we must slide down by the stern, by the tiller itself, from the area of which a rope is hanging down, which maintains guard over the ship. And that's the bit that, again, most people bracket. Now that is a straightforward gloss, I think, explanation on the rope. It doesn't relate to any other passage of the text. It's just a straightforward gloss. And the classical texts are full of these apparent explanations which just get into the text. Looking back at our picture, you can see how that might happen. Okay, now I want to, that's a fairly basic idea. Now I want to move to something a bit more sophisticated, and this is where I suppose reception comes in. So, as in the Chinese tradition, the classical tradition, there are classic texts which are read in education, annotated over centuries, and central, of course, from the beginning, are the works of Homer. And I want to give you a few examples of the interrelation between the works of Homer and the works of Virgil. Homer writing probably in the 7th century BC or possibly earlier, depending on whom you believe. Virgil writing in the 1st century BCE. But self-consciously writing in the same tradition, Homer, of course, is the beginning of the Greek epic tradition, the story of the Iliad, the War of Troy, not as in Brad Pitt. There are good bits in that movie, but and the story of the Odyssey. And Virgil, in a sense, combining both of these into the Aeneid, which is both the war story and the return story. So very self-consciously writing in the same tradition. And you could say in some ways that the Aeneid was both a commentary and a reception of Homer. It has a very engaged relationship with its predecessor. But I want to give you some examples from the kind of work done by Schlunk in his book of Homeric Scholia and the Aeneid, which basically makes a very simple argument that, and we should remember this, characters like Virgil are reading characters like Homer with commentary. So just as we read Shakespeare plays with commentary, or read classical texts with commentary, or read Chinese classical texts with commentary, this was already going on in the Roman Empire, and indeed much earlier in Greek literature as well. So here, commentary can become a tool, a channel in the reception of a text. It can be built into how people look at a text in the future. So some examples of that. Now, in the Odyssey, you may remember Odysseus is shipwrecked on an island where he meets the rich king Alcinous, who takes a shine to him. And Odysseus is still in disguise at this point, he hasn't said who he is. And Alcinous, perhaps rather enthusiastically, offers him his daughter in marriage. He's quite impressed by this unknown stranger. And again, Alcinous answered him and said, "Stranger, the heart in my breast is not such as to be filled with wrath without a cause." So it's just a translation I stole from the internet, there are better ones. "Better is due measure in all things. I would, O Father Zeus and Athena and Apollo, that you, so fine a man, and like-minded with me, would have my daughter to wife, be called my son, and abide here. A house and possessions would I give you, if you chose to remain." So this is a bit sudden, really. He's known this guy for, what, 2 hours. He says, "We'd like to stay here and marry my daughter." And the beta scalia, which probably are connected with the great critic Aristarchus, writing in Alexandria in the 2nd century BC, this is the great age and place of Homeric commentary, he wants to take these lines out because he, as one might naturally feel, thinks that they're not quite what the king should say at this point. And this is what the scholar is saying. Scholar is just a general name for notes for commentary. "For how, when he does not know the man, can he engage his daughter to him, not urging but beseeching him, saying, please, please, marry my daughter? The wish, they say, is bizarre, atopos in Greek. For though he neither knows who he is or tries to find out, he wishes to take him into his house and make him his son-in-law." So that's clear criticism of, shall we say, the realism here, the characterization that Alcinous, this is an improbable atopon thing for Alcinous to do. And when we get a parallel scene in Virgil's Aeneid, when the king again offers a recent visitor his daughter in marriage, these apparent holes, which Aristarchus noticed, are filled in. So King Latinus says to Aeneas, who isn't in disguise, he knows who he is, he has extensive material on his background, he's done a CV check, if you like, he's Googled him. He says, "My dwelling holds a daughter, whom with husband of her own blood great signs in heaven and from my father's tomb forbid to wed. A son from alien shores they prophesy for Latium's heir, whose seed will lift our glory to the stars divine. I am persuaded this is none but he, that man of destiny, and if my heart be no false prophet, I desire it so." So you've got the same scenario. King wants to marry his daughter to recent visitor, but there's much more of an argument because there's a prophecy which says that he has to marry his daughter to a foreigner, and Aeneas, the guy, is a foreigner. And service is commentary, so it's CE, not BCE, from 400 AD. Commentary on this passage says, "Many people criticize Virgil for depicting Latinus as promising his daughter unprompted, but they do not take into account the oracle." So actually, people who criticize Virgil are really criticizing Homer, because Homer is producing something that's slightly bizarre. But Servius must be right that Virgil noticed this through the Scalia, perhaps, and filled that gap, gave Latinus a convincing reason for offering his daughter to this new visitor. So here we can see commentary operating as reception of the text, and we can see the next generation of literary texts reworking the story in response to the commentary, and that's a form of reception. A couple more similar examples. Symbolic snake portents. Now, in the second book of the Iliad, we have sort of Agamemnon's big error, where he falsely says to the Greeks that it's he wants to encourage the Greeks to get on with conquering Troy. He tries to do this by falsely saying, oh, let's all go home. And it misfires, and they all do want to go home. And this is Odysseus's attempt, a successful attempt, to try and persuade the Greeks from not going home. They've been there for 9 years, camped in Troy, very uncomfortable. And he tells a story about this snake. And we have a long kind of account of it, which I won't read, but what you can see is that we've got a snake that consumes the birds, and Calchas the prophet is reported by Odysseus as saying, even as the serpent devoured the sparrow's little ones and the mother with them, this is the end of the passage, the eighth, and the mother of the bird was the ninth, so shall we war there for so many years. But in the tenth, shall we take Broadway City, we'll conquer Troy. And that's what Calchas said, and now it's all coming to pass. Now, chances are, of course, this is a highly invented story by Odysseus, who's a famously fictionalizing character. But again, we have this story has interpretation in the commentaries and then consequences in Virgil's later narrative. So in the beast scale again, we have the interpretation of the portent. The tree is the way to the city, and the fact that the movement of the snake is not naturally straight. You know, the snake is zigzagging. Where's that bit? Yes. So it's important that the snake zigzags around. The fact the movement of the snake is not naturally straight reflects the equally crooked journey of the Greeks, such as happened to them departing and then turning back. Now that is an allusion to their later action. But the point I want to make is that this interpretation, allegorical interpretation of the prophecy, is being picked up by Virgil's next passage. And that's from Aeneid 2. This is the famous moment where the two snakes come in and do over the priest Lycaon, which is depicted in the famous Lycaon sculpture. Lo, over the tranquil deep from Tendos appear the pair, our shadows I tell, of vastly coiling serpents, side by side, stretching along the ways and the shores, taking swift course, their necks were lifted high, their gory dragon crest o'ertop the waves. All else half seen fell low on the sea, while the loud cleavage of the foamy brine, their monstrous backs wound forward, fold on the fold. And here, Tiberius Plautus Donatus, who's another commentator on Virgil from late antiquity, makes a similar kind of allegorical commentary, which I think is correct. We can by this portent foresee that clear destruction is impending, for it signified that enemies would come from Tenedos, mighty and twin in number. So the same kind of allegorical interpretation, which the scholia are marking out on Homer, becomes part of Virgil's text. I mean, you have to, in context, you have to read this episode as giving the allegory that Donatus says it does. So here you can see again commentary being incorporated into the later reception of this story in a similar, but they're both snake portents, and one really picks up the other. A couple of other similar examples, item C. In Odyssey 6, the shipwrecked Odysseus meets the princess Nausicaa, who's the princess who was being promised to him a moment ago. And he's in a bit of a bind because he's stark naked, and she's there with her nymphs in a slightly embarrassing social situation. And so he has to make a pretty nifty speech. Odysseus is characterized, of course, as someone who's very good at speaking and assessing what he has to say in any situation. So, translation, as he pondered, it seemed to him better to stand apart and beseech her with gentle words. At this point, he's holding a branch in front of his vitals. Lest the maiden's heart should be wroth with him, he clasped her knees in supplication. So straightway he spoke as gentle word and crafty. I beseech thee, O queen, a goddess thou art, or art thou mortal? If thou art a goddess, one of those who hold broad heaven, for Artemis, the daughter of great Zeus, do I liken thee, most dearly in comeliness and in stature and in form. And again, we have commentary from from the Hellenistic period, probably saying he did the right thing here. To converse with a right artist of divinity would have made an impression of flattery. To say you must be a goddess straight off is over the top. But in doubting, he advances a more believable proposition. This is finally ordered, for he comes with suspicion of divinity first of all, as if inclining rather to that. So here Vesalius praises Odysseus for his subtle indirection. But when we get the parallel scene in the Aeneid, so Aeneas, forced to land at Carthage, meets his divine mother Venus in disguise. Perhaps she's the goddess of sex, and she's disguised as a virgin, which is funny. And she kind of chats up her son, which is even funnier. So Venus spoke, and Venus's son replied, "No voice or vision of thy sister fair has crossed my path, thou maid without a name. Thy beauty seems not of terrestrial mould, nor is thy music mortal. Tell me, goddess for sure, Dea Cate, art thou bright Phoebus' sister, or some nymph, the daughter of a god? Whate'er thou art, thy faith we implore from potent aid in our vast poem." So what you get there is a more direct approach than you get in Homer. Aeneas is a less subtle speaker than Odysseus. He's also more Roman, and this may reflect cultural difference between Greeks and Romans. Romans thought of themselves as plain speaking, more direct than the Greeks, who they thought went around the houses too much. And of course, the difference in the Aeneid is this is a goddess. In the Odyssey, it's a girl who can be compared to a goddess. In Aeneid, it is a real goddess, and it's his mother. It's Aeneas' mother, Venus. So again, you can see how commentary, reading of commentary, leads to the rewriting of the scene in a slightly different way, which fits the cultural parameters of Rome as against Greece, and that again is one of the areas of reception I'm interested in, the idea of cultural difference between texts here, mediated by commentary. And finally, grinding, like this example. So in the Iliad, you remember the story, Achilles, after the death of Patroclus, Achilles is pretty cross and he comes back into the battle wanting to kill all the Trojans. In their midst, goodly Achilles arrayed him for battle. There was a gnashing of his teeth and his two eyes blazed as it had been a flame of fire, and into his heart there entered grief that might not be borne. Thus, in fierce wrath against the Trojans, he clad him in the gifts of the god that Hephaestus had wrought for him with toil. And again, here we meet Aristarchus, the critic we saw before, and the Tiscalia, another Hellenistic commentary, say that these four lines are athetized, that's say cut out, probably by Aristarchus. And Achilles' grinding of teeth is ridiculous, loyal, so it's a bit like the atopon we had earlier, bizarre. Now, that's a remark on this passage saying, Homer did it wrong, people don't grind their teeth. And as a result, I think the Aeneid takes this on board, Virgil, and such grinding is reserved for subhuman monsters and animals. Polyphemus, the Cyclops, Cacus, the monster giant who lives on the site of Rome, and a wild boar in a simile which comes straight out of Homer. And very interesting, this last passage, where what we have in the transmitted text is a word order which actually gives us a person who's grinding their teeth. So I'll read the translation at the bottom. Well, I'll just read the beginning again. As when a wild boar, so he's the warrior Mezentius is compared to the wild boar. And at the end, he, all unterrified, makes frequent stand, gnashing his teeth, and shakes off their spears from his hide. Now you might say that's a bit strange anyway. But again, modern scholars have, after the example of Scaliger in the 16th century, have rightly, I think, reordered these lines, as I did in my own edition years ago. And that actually means that the gnashing of teeth is not by the man, but by the boar. And I think that's correct. I think that is as a result of reading this commentary. So again, you can see how commentary acts as a reception and intermediary for the next generation of writers. So really that's just a few examples of how commentary can very much, in practical terms, influence the reception and indeed interpretation of texts.
Thank you.
So one strand of commentary was about what does this mean in practice?
Yeah.
Showing the first guy, James 1, that seemed to be quite so. In, hang on, I'm just going to go by my notes. So when you're commentary on ritual, how much is it moving towards this is what it means, this is how you do it in practice? How strong a strand of that is it moving from a sort of textual, moving it from text to something that you can getting clear about how you act it out? Or is that just one among many?
I've only looked at one example of that, which was the Soul of Gods. I think in the case of the ancestral shrouds, which are much more common, there's not so much of that because people already knew kind of what to do. But yeah, that's one thing that particular guy did. Of course, the sub-commentaries from much later times, from the 6th and 7th centuries, gives a lot more detail about everything. And sometimes it comments on the main commentary as well as on the original text. Yeah. So we call it a sub-commentary. So how much there is of that, I'm not sure, but there is a fair bit. I mean, he does that quite a bit, so reading it without his commentary is really quite a struggle. But of course not everyone believes everything he says either.
I was wondering about, because your text that you looked at, both of you, I think it was quite obvious where the commentary was, or they were brackets, so I think even in the signs you could tell that they were commentaries. I guess it's not the case all the time, and how do you differentiate voices, or can you tell the difference between the text and the commentary?
This is ongoing work by editors, because you can see how easy it is for marginal interlinear words to be incorporated into the text. Of course, it's much easier if it's verse, because then you can tell from meter. But in prose text, that's really why I began with a prose text for Jonas, because you really have to do it on the sense and the context, because the bits of the bracket are perfectly good Latin. Sometimes they even fit and aren't mistakes. So you have to make a judgment. I suppose it's a kind of critical judgment about whether this passage is appropriate or not in the context. And in not everyone, most people would agree with the deletions that the scholars make, but not everyone. So it's partly a question of your judgment about the text, about whether, for example, whether it is the kind of text that contains fairly basic explanations. I don't think Petronius is myself, because I think it's an elegantly written fictional text. But if I had a different belief about Petronius, I'd have a different belief about these interpolations. So in the end, it comes down to how you as a critic want to read that particular text, provided that the language is correct or the meter is correct or whatever. In the end, it comes down to the judgment of literary interpretation. Which is why we're still arguing about it centuries on.
This isn't a question as so much as I'd like to hear your opinion, because you have vast knowledge of the specific sort of history of commentary, and it's a question on what makes a classic or what is a classic. So to what extent do you think the practice of commentary contributes to the institution of a classical text with reference to Confucius and Virgil? And I'm sure you're familiar with T.S. Eliot's notion of Virgil being the source of the European mind. And so on the one hand, you can think of classical text as something that transcends time and place in a non-fatuous way, because there's something wonderful about the text itself, which raises it above all these differences. On the other hand, you could the opposite view would be a very unsympathetic view, that each epoch recreates the text and invests in the text for their own reasons and gets constituted as sort of sociocultural acts. And with your knowledge of the history of commentary, I just wanted to hear your opinion on where you were in this divided sort of poles of thought.
Interesting question. I mean, for one thing, I think in the early period, in the early imperial period, the Han Dynasty, a lot of the sort of texts of masters, philosophers, and so on also attracted commentaries. I suspect that some of the earlier sort of canonical texts have an early, even earlier layer of commentary. So you have the Spring and Autumn Annals, and they have another kind of commentary called the Dryad, which in some cases is really almost an independent text that's been kind of shaped to fit the original. And those very definitely are, because they come packaged with the canonical text, they're quite, one of those is quite almost like the Bible. It's sort of like a lot of the historical chapters of the Bible. You know, it's very terse, but very kind of resonant of a very different world. And I think that the very existence of those three Dryad commentaries did, packaged with it, did sort of help propel the thing into even more of a canonical status. So hard to say. In the case of the ritual text, probably John Chan himself was the one who really defined the canon, and without him having done that, it's hard to say, maybe others would have done it as well, because others were studying the text, but he put the three together and took them almost like a package. So probably did, in quite practical terms, see that it was sort of launched as a, you know, a canonical text, or a classic, as many people call it.
I think in the classical world, pretty much canons determined by educational structures. So that the decision probably in Athens to make Homer the centre of education meant that Homer became the central text, which meant that Homer became the subject of commentary. And you can see exactly the same thing happening in the Roman Empire. So, for example, the fact we only have seven plays of Sophocles is because they were selected to be the school text at a particular point in history and received commentary, and were the only seven plays preserved out of over 100 plays. So even within an author, that canonical selection can have a drastic effect on the transmission and the reading of text. But I think it's absolutely education. So the choice to make epic, these long poems like Homer and Virgil, the centre of Greek and Roman education, led inevitably to them being the subject of commentary and the subject, in effect, of canonisation and the canon. You can see varying tastes over time, which means that some texts come in and some come out. But essentially, the key texts like Homer, Virgil, Greek tragedy remain in. And of course, saying earlier, when Christianity comes in, you get exactly the same thing with the Bible and commentaries on the Bible and theological texts, because that then becomes the centre of another kind of education, and again requires exegesis, commentary, and again has this kind of ideological institutional centrality, which maybe people sometimes say Homer is the Bible of the Greeks. Ideologically that doesn't make much sense, but in terms of its the centrality of the Homeric text to education and the need that's thereby created for commentary, that is a good way of thinking.
Okay. Yeah, they're over a Chinese case, these texts. Mm.
I was also wondering, just by asking a question, relating your two talks together. So Stephen, you were talking about the criticism on Homer, such as saying Alcinous is too brusque in offering his daughter, in the characterization of Achilles and his teeth. There seems to me to be an attitude on the commentator's part of criticizing the author or saying this creation is not an optimal choice. Whereas Robert mentioned with Chinese commentators, they're usually very respectful to this canonical text. And even if they want to incorporate some of their own views, they would do that in a very indirect way to say that, oh, actually they said it, I didn't say it. So it seems to me that the attitudes of commentators are quite different. Could you make some comments on this?
It's an interesting cultural difference, isn't it?
Although they did correct errors in the text. You know, things that they said this character is wrong, and it should be this. Mm-hmm.
But that's so that more on a textual transmission.
Yeah. And also that, in a way, is identifying the real canonical text, as opposed to the critic that wouldn't
usually criticize.
Yeah. But maybe education also plays a role here too, because when we're talking about things like when you should give your daughter away, that's not just a kind of question of literary appropriateness, there might be a kind of ethical, societal dimension to that. And we were talking earlier about what is the context in which these commentaries are generated. Well, the ones that I'm talking about on the whole are for educational use and show considerable interest in moralising for young people. So when you grow up, don't give your daughter to the first stranger, as opposed to really know who they are, might be some kind of ethical lesson that's being purveyed. So again, we're so used to aesthetic criticism being what we do. Could say it's ideological in terms, but what we think we're doing is we're looking to text and seeing, do we like that bit, do we not like that bit? But in the commentaries that I'm talking about here on Hammond and Virgil, there's always an educational framework and therefore probably some kind of ethical, sort of hortative, normative framework saying, is this the kind of thing that you ought to do? Because ancient education is very much organised about training the character, training the ethos, and Burns reading Hammond and Virgil called the people like Quintilian to learn the right kind of stuff about the world, not to have aesthetic pleasure at reading interesting literary texts, which is how we see it. So I think what fascinates me always with commentary is, where is it coming from? What is the ideology of commentary? You can do this with modern literary commentary. Meta-commentary is now a very interesting discipline in classics. And a friend of mine wrote a book called Oxford Reds, which was about a series of red commentaries on classical texts by Oxford University Press, in which he kind of exposed the ideological underbelly of why people wrote commentaries on Catullus leaving out the dirty poems, for example. And I think we always have to think about those frameworks. It's just really handy to know who, when the commentator's writing, what their environment is, are they doing it for a school environment or whatever. I mean, often we don't know, but in the case of Servius and of the commentators and Hamlet, we have a good idea of the kind of environment they're working in. Do we know? Well, it looks like we have quite good ideas about who some of these guys are in the training session, and that must really help.
So it's always very non-specific in terms of sort of provincial society. It's always very capital-oriented and there was kind of an imperial academy.
Yeah.
And in a way, these canonical texts became defined because they were the set texts, the syllabus for the imperial academy that people had to master if they were to become officials.
But when they're writing on, let's say, the Confucian tradition, you can assume that there's some kind of Confucian ideology operating.
Yes.
So what then happened to the practice of commentaries? Does one find this being done after the classical period?
I'm still doing it.
No, more recent texts. I mean, not on the original text, but you don't see commentaries on 20th century literature.
Do you? Well, for example, modernist literature, let's take T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, because there's famous commentary on that, part of it by Eliot himself. You can't really read James Joyce's Ulysses without some of that commentary help. And I think this is coming back, partly because, as I see it in English studies, that there's more tendency now to produce commentaries on modern authors, like John Fuller's commentary on Orton, for example. Partly because we need more help with complex texts than we used to. And it's kind of coming back, it's my impression, how Matthew thinks about that.
No, I think that's right. I mean, so the John Fuller example is to be aware of, it pushes in different directions, and it's derivative by commentary, so there's a deconstructive way of...
It's a poet-on-poet reaction commentary party.
Sure, there is that. I know it can play out in different ways, so the one kind of deconstructive way of doing commentary would be a sort of, you know, kind of opening up of possibilities, I suppose, and kind of teasing apart. And the other way, the other kind of, obviously all commentaries no doubt do different things in different directions. But something I was wondering about, listening to both of you, was the degree to which commentary does something in terms of genre, which is to say takes this text and turns it into something a bit different, turns it, moves it more towards being a speech act rather than towards being a text, when you take it, some words and say, oh, they mean this, or this is the context for them, you're pinning them down a bit more than if you just got the text by itself. So when I was asking about, is it, you know, how you use the text, that I had in mind, I was wondering with some of the interpolations into the Satyricon, whether there was a kind of genre question there, which is to say that reader is looking, so that Petronius, in his writing, it's fine to put a character in out of nowhere, whereas the person reading it is thinking,
yeah,
this is a problem. No. Where's this character come from?
Yes.
So that reader has a genre anxiety that we would associate with realism to some extent, which is, yes, to say you have to explain where the characters come from, and so is wanting to shift the genre of that text. And so what you see very precisely is a kind of meeting of genre expectations and a text that's not quite fulfilling them, and so are wanting to kind of, you know, change the text in order to do this.
Well, I think in the end it ends up pointing out the aesthetic of the text, yeah, which is that things do happen suddenly and unexpectedly,
yeah,
which is why it makes such a great film,
yeah,
because cuts between scenes really work for, yeah, for Satyricon. Yes, I think it, a literal-minded reader who wants to make connections with everything is the kind of reader who puts in those annotations, but it exposes the fact that this is not a very literally consequential text.
Yeah.
You're forever having to fill in gaps. Now, in that sense, it's more like a poetic narrative than a prose narrative.
Yeah.
But it's hard to know. Well, it's hard to know when these interpolations take place, because our manuscripts are probably much later than the point at which this stuff actually gets into the text. So they've been copied a number of times. But one possibility would be, say, the Carolingian period, when there was lots of annotation going on. And then you have to ask, what are the paradigms for a narrative in that period? Well, they're probably something like history or chronicle, something where you do have an orderly sequence and A, B, C do follow, and you don't have sort of surreal cuts, yeah, between scenes.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'd really love to know the, yes, date and circumstances of these interpolations, which we can't do in the nature of the evidence as it is.
Yes.
Because then you could say what they were trying to do. Okay, you could say they're trying to explain it for a reader who needs to understand connections.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they coming from? Would be my interest. And I mean, as I get older, I'm much more interested in the kind of ideology and history of scholarship, because I've seen so much of it during my own lifetime, of where people,
yeah,
are coming from. Actually explains quite a lot about what they're doing.
Yeah.
Thank you for the talk. My question is, I want to know how fragmented the original text could be, because I wonder if people like Zheng Xuan, when he was trying to organize or make the text as a system, he had to choose something. He doesn't just pick up things from this room and that room and make a system. I wonder how fragmented this original text is. It is like a puzzle, and you just, what we see is just a part of that, or it's like two totally different puzzles, and Zheng Xuan pick them up together. If it is the puzzle itself and we see just part of the puzzle, we could say the text itself is actually open for systemization. It itself has the potential to become a system itself, and people just try to elaborate and make it readable to the younger generations. What's your idea?
Well, I think actually by the time Zheng Xuan got a hold of these texts, they were quite stable. But the process you're describing was happening sort of at the very end of the Western Han with Liu Xiang, with the Liu Xin. They were the ones who were doing exactly that. They had these bamboo slips, wooden slips, that were just scattered all over the place, and they were fitting everything together. And so even modern talk philologists figure out how many characters are usually on a strip, and then they count and they say, this whole section doesn't belong here, it must be somewhere else. And people are still doing that now. So I'm trying to remember whether I've ever seen him do that. He usually is single characters. This character is wrong because it doesn't make sense, because his approach is quite different from most Han, you know, his philological method. Usually the earlier scholars would always, and other scholars would always work from the bottom up, character by character, and work out all the correct ones. And he seemed to be able to digest the meaning of the whole passage and work down. and say that because the whole passage means this, that means this character can't be right, this word must be a different word. So it's quite striking that, I mean, he was obviously a very gifted and brilliant man who was doing something differently, but I don't remember him ever commenting on actual bamboo slips, although Zhuxi, the guy I met, mentioned at the end, did, and actually, you know, sort of made some quite dramatic changes to a couple of texts.
Now, on the classic side, there's a kind of similar situation with the works of Homer. Now, we read the Iliad and the Odyssey with 24 books each, but those divisions were put in probably 400 years after Homer. So that's an example of the way in which commentators and editors could actually restructure a text. And we look at these book divisions and we say, yes, isn't that a wonderful mirror structure and so on. But these are decisions by commentators, they're not decisions by an author. Now, in the case of Homer, you have probably a particularly unstable text early on because it results from a process of oral composition. This is the big debate about Homer, of course. Most people think it was in some sense already composed. What they debate about is when it was written down. But clearly there is big flexibility at the beginning. But it's very striking that the units in which we read Homer, rather like the verses in which we read the Christian Bible, are a later commentator-editor imposition. And that can make quite a difference to interpretation.
I think it went back to a few questions ago, the issue of genre expectations. And I guess I'm curious, I mean, particularly in the Chinese case, I mean, are there situations where the sort of the very different genre expectations associated with these different bibliographic categories might result in very different types of commentary or sort of commentarial projects? And I mean, for example, is commentary on historical texts kind of pursuing a sort of canonizing project in a similar way, or not so much?
So, I mean, some of the, my impression is that the Han commentaries of sort of master's texts are very similar to the classical ones. They do the same, use the same methods, and it seems to be doing the same sort of thing. So you get texts like Yu Shu Chunqiu or Huainan's, and then you get the guy's name who wrote the commentaries to those in Eastern Han. And in the case of the histories, they're all a little bit different. The Shiji commentators are all sort of six dynasties, and then the Tang kind of gathered them all together and listened to the Jijie, and they put them all together so that you could see them. And in the case of Ban Gu, it was, what's the guy's name? It was a Tang band who wrote the commentary on that. And then we had a Yuan dynasty character who wrote a commentary on the Zidri Tongjie, you know, which is a Song text, so very late. But once you get past the first four histories, those are kind of the classical ones, as it were, the kind of the individual efforts, and after them by committee, the others don't have commentaries for the Jishu onward.
Yeah, I guess that's another, sorry, a question.
It's okay.
that maybe applies more broadly. I mean, do you think it's fair to say that, you know, since there's sort of a range of different possible motivations for commentary, are there places where they might interact oddly or unexpectedly? You know, for example, I mean, is there sort of a tension between commentary applied to a text that because it's difficult and needs explanation, and then commentary applied to a text almost for the opposite reason, because it's really well known and educationally important and everyone's reading it?
Quite often you get unexpected results in the commentaries. From our perspective, we expect them to explain or comment on something really major, and they do something completely different, partly because they're coming from a different tradition. But also this issue of genre is that certainly in the Latin Empire, commentators are easily diverted into other kinds of writing. So for example, grammar, some of them were clearly grammatically teachers of literature at the grammatical level, and quite often their notes seem to get pushed off in that direction. Mythography is another one that a trigger in a text will
bring forth a paragraph of mythography which is not strictly necessary in the context. Or, and Tiberius Claudius Donatus, one of the ones I quoted on Virgil, is a rhetorician, and so he always slants towards a rhetorical type of analysis, almost like a rhetorical treatise. So these things can move across quite quickly, and I think what strikes most people about ancient commentaries is their lack of consistency in their own empire, that even if they have got particular interests, they don't always fulfill them.
I have a related question for Robert. By the time Confucian ritual canons reach Korea, especially around the 17th century, it clearly turns into a repressive state ideology, you know, to support the state apparatuses. So I was wondering what the Chinese Orthodox Confucian scholars, if there is such a thing, think of the neo Confucianism in Korea. Do they accept this as part of the Confucian tradition, or is it something completely outside of it?
I'm not sure they even know or knew much about it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, but as far as I know, I mean, certainly the rituals, there was another text compiled by Duxi that was family rituals meant for ordinary people, and that was influential in China and in Korea, and to some extent in Japan. So for some reason that was kind of like a advanced writer, a simpler text, kind of wrote in and influenced a lot of popular custom. I mean, some people say that the Koreans were more Confucian than the Chinese. Confucianism was accepted by a much larger proportion of the population, because in China it's really very narrow elite. And only in a very vague way is Confucian's values, are they even Confucian at all, eventually, you know, filial piety and so on, do sort of take hold amongst the population, but they existed before Confucius, so whether they're really Confucian, it's hard to say.
But on the other hand, you mentioned that one of the Confucian ideas is that the rituals or transformation education is open to everyone, not exclusively on one culture.
Well, and especially like the last man, Duxi, worked very hard to promulgate correct Confucian ritual amongst the common people, because they thought he could change their customs and improve them morally. Mm-hmm. If they did their weddings and funerals in the right way, that would be sort of like a beachhead for the actual more advanced teachings eventually take hold. But yes, they did think that, especially if you get Li, then there are countries that know Li, and they're civilized countries. And people would mention Korea and Vietnam as being countries which know Li, and then countries which don't yet know Li, like Japan, that are. But you know, people say, you know, like Zhu Shunshu said, like, you can do it. It's just a matter of, you know, education, spreading it, and you too can become a civilized country like us.
Could I ask about this tricky issue of the circulation of authority, which you raised very starkly at the beginning, Robert, when you said about the Confucian text, it was taken for granted that there was truth in the texts, but it wasn't at all obvious what it was.
Yeah.
So the commentator then had to,
yeah,
you know, and so then when you're the person who, that's a very strange, I mean, but, you know, partly you want to say, well, that's a very strange position, taking for granted that there's truth in the text, except you have to then work to find out what it is. But then on the other hand, that's the position, in a sense, in a sort of display sense, that's the position that we're always in as interpreters of any text. And so I felt that also that strongly in relation to the instances of the Scolia, when they were saying, this can't be in Homer because it's ridiculous, which is, say, what you see there is a notion of reverence for the text must be like this, and therefore the actuality of the text, of what I got, falls short of what must be in the text, and so the prime to adjust it accordingly. I mean, I suppose one thing I wondered is whether there was any hint of the thought there is in later, so as I understand, in later editorial practice, which is to say that if it's peculiar, then it's more likely to be true than if it's not, or whether it's kind of consistent adapting to the expectation of what it ought to be like. The other thing I felt actually was I was a little bit disappointed by how docile Virgil seemed to be in relation to these commentaries, which is to say that he seemed to sort of follow, he seemed to kind of adopt for himself the strictures that they had for for Homer, except I love the bit, I love the background of, to, you know, oh, certainly a goddess, oh, dear Chester, I love the background of that bit, and that you can imagine reading what they say about Odysseus in Norse Scar, and thinking, I can, let me try to imagine a scene in which it's okay to say, you are a goddess, and that's where I kind of thought that had a nice impish possible image as to it. But I mean, basically, the question I wanted to ask was this question about the circulation of authority, this sort of displaced authority, and I don't really know what I'm asking about it, so for more reflections on it.
Biblical exegesis, theology is kind of takes the truth of the, presumably, I mean, I don't know which Bible, but it presumably takes the truth of the Bible as a given, and then it's just a matter of interpreting what it's actually saying. I mean, presumably a lot of people here know more about that than I do.
Three levels on that.
But I mean, what it comes down to, practice, so as a kind of person faced with the text, thinking, and it can, you know, it can play out in different ways, can't it? And you can have inner certainty that your view of the text of the text is, or you can be more responsive to different aspects of it, or you can change your mind about it. As you know,
in the case of Virgil and Homer and the kind of intervening commentary, you could say that Virgil is showing sort of cultural superiority, kind of saying he's not making the mistakes that Homer makes, just as Virgil's implicit claim is that he can do the 48 books of Homer as he received them in 12 in the Iliad. It's the kind of new and improved.
Suited to the pace of modern work.
Design and bites,
I wonder about when people read the Iliad when it came out, did they think, oh, this is just derivative or a bit of an improvement, or did they think that all of these kind of rather familiar, really old seeming things actually made it have kind of the ring of something real, something old?
Both these things occur in the early criticism of Virgil. I mean, the first review of the Aeneid is pre-publication, and it says, yield, ye writers of Rome, yield, ye writers of Greece, something bigger than the Iliad is happening. That's precocious while Virgil's still in Britain. But then they
can't. That was sarcastic, though. Is that completely wrong?
No. No, I think it's fairly encomiastic in context. But when we get to, say, like Macrobius's Saturnalia, which is a kind of digest of commentator interpretation work on the Aeneid in the Roman Empire, then you do have people who say, when there's a whole book on what Virgil stole from Homer, and there's another book on how Virgil improved Homer. So you can have both these things in the same work. Yeah. And that's a response to the terminus.